This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to another week of Best of the Festivals here on Radio National Summer. I'm Cassie McCullough and today we're taking a deep dive into the latest novel from award-winning writer and academic Sarah Moss with RN's Kate Evans as our guide.
Hello and welcome to this conversation with British writer Sarah Moss here at the Melbourne Writers' Festival and on air and podcast on ABC RN. Sarah Moss's fiction includes Summer Water and Ghost Wall. She's also written non-fiction works on the history of chocolate, on strangers in Iceland, and on eating, cooking, reading and writing in British women's fiction in the late 18th century. Today, though, we're going to concentrate especially on her eighth novel, The Fell. Sarah, hello.
Hey, Dan. Thank you.
Well, let's begin with this new novel of yours, The Fell. It begins confined, inside houses, people unable to leave. But there are hills that beckon just outside of town, and that's the Fell. So where are we? What is this place?
This is the Peak District in northern England. It's the, well, I was going to say the wild area. Of course, there isn't really any wilderness in Europe anymore, but it's the wild-looking area between Sheffield and Manchester, so two big industrial cities. And I chose it partly because I love it and I was missing it, but also because it has quite a vexed history in terms of land access. Because it's between those two big industrial cities, it was always used as the recreational area by factory workers and people who didn't get to leave the city during the week. And then there was a huge battle over land access and hiking in the early 20th century, which was really iconic for British conversations about who's allowed to be where and which bodies are allowed to be on which land. So that was one of the reasons for choosing it.
And so as well as the nature itself, which you evoke so strongly in the novel, it seems to be a place that's intercut and crossed over with dry stone walls, with stiles, with what, ancient pathways, are they?
Yeah. I mean, not probably, well, who knows really how old a pathway is. They're called coffin routes. They're very accessible because they were kind of semi-paved so that you could carry coffins down from the high farms and villages to the churches in the valleys. And yes, some of those are pretty old.
And so that's a sort of big picture of this place, the Fells. But what does this place mean to your character, Kate?
It's her place of escape and sanity. She lives on the side of the Fell, on the mountainside. It's been interesting talking about this book. Some people clearly think she's desperately poor, and for other people it's pretty normal, and for me it's pretty normal. But she's not in any way prosperous or comfortable, and her consolation is to go up onto the hills every day, and she does that in all weathers and has done all her life. So then when lockdown comes, she's not allowed to do that, and she finds that extraordinarily hard.
And so this novel takes place during lockdown. But before we get to that, I mean, she's living with her teenage son, Matt. But what else? What's shaped her life, this woman?
It's fairly ordinary, I think. She had an abusive marriage, which she eventually left. She's now a single parent. She's a folk singer. Singing is really what she loves, but she's not, well, she's semi-professional. She gets paid for doing gigs in pubs. And she holds things together by working as a waitress in a cafe. So the things that really keep her life together have all been taken away by COVID. The pubs are closed, the cafe's closed. She's not allowed onto the Fells. So really all her resources are gone.
She's quite a passionate woman, isn't she? I mean, what does her sort of ideology mean to her?
She just tries to live well in the slightly messy way that anybody might. She's worried about the environment in as much as her budget allows. She tries to consume minimally and to reduce, reuse and recycle. They're vegetarian. She grows her own vegetables. But for her, those are really just ways of not feeling like part of the problem or feeling less like part of the problem.
I'm glad you use the word messy for her, because she is complicated and messy, as we all are. But perhaps you could take us inside her head by reading something from this novel for us.
This is from near the beginning. Her wellies lean on each other at the back door. She pulls them on, notices mud on the jeans she's been wearing. How many days? She has been doing laundry, some laundry. It's not as if she and Matt aren't changing their pants, though she gave up on bras early on, just another thing to wash. That's something else she could get rid of, though even someone in principle willing to consider a second-hand bra wouldn't consider hers, greying with elastic worms coming out of the straps. They can probably be upcycled into something, lampshades or Christmas decorations. She can almost imagine them in the craft gallery. And she has been known to use old holy knickers as floor cloths. There's less to a bra, less absorbency. She leaves the door open and wanders down the garden. There will be daffodils along the path here in spring, and tulips over there, the dark purple ones sold as black. Kale's holding up. They should have some more of that tonight. Though it feels as if all her cooking has turned into the same thing. Some kind of vegetable and tinned tomato slop on rice. Grated cheese if you're desperate. She hadn't realised how much she relied on what came from the cafe. Quiches, whatever salads wouldn't last another day. There was a scheme to deliver some of the leftovers to people living on the streets. But the van came only twice a week. And the other days the staff divvied it up, squabbling over Joe's lentil thing with the horseradish, being polite about the coleslaw. God knows what the homeless people are eating now, though from what she's heard, provision's been a bit better since the pandemic. Turns out when people are worried about catching something from street sleepers, there's suddenly funding available for safe places to stay and hot meals. Kate sees a slug, silvery on the pine blue kale, pulls it off and puts it down on the bird table, wipes her hand on her jeans. She wishes sometimes you could sign a disclaimer, like a do not resuscitate order, promising that if you get sick, you won't go to hospital, won't make any demands or expect any help. And in exchange, you could take your own risks, decide how much you want to stay alive and at what cost to your sanity. But of course, that's not how it works. It's not the government care if you feel ill or die cheaply at home. It's that they care if you pass the illness to people who will die expensively in hospital. And it's no use individuals trying to opt out. We're biologically connected to each other. And anyway, that's not how society works. She knows that. You can't sign out of community. And it's not that usually she'd want to. She doesn't disapprove of lockdown or masks or any of it. Not on principle. Only the longer this goes on, the less she objects to dying. And the harder it is to understand why other people don't feel the same way. There's birdsong now. Some small piping voice in the hedge. Wind not much in the bare apple tree. From here she can see across the fields to the hill. It feels like another country up there, especially in winter when there's no one around, when you can walk an hour or two before you see someone else, you and the wind and the sky. She can see from here there's no one on the path. She'd actually be further from another soul there than here, less likely to pass on disease. It'll be quiet up there, the cloud muffling sound rising from the valley. If you go far enough, you come to places where you can't hear traffic. There used to be planes. You used to be able to watch them circling Manchester Airport, banking and winging west to America and south to Europe. But now there are only birds in the sky. There'll be wind through the sleeping winter heather and the bracken bright brown and the streams cold and clear. No scent on the wind, just winter. Everything biding its time, gathering strength underground, sleeping and waiting for the darkest days, the hinge of the year and then the return of the light. Sheep huddled in their wool but pregnant, earth sodden and swollen with autumn's rainfall. Kate's back in the house changing the wellies for hiking boots, taking the backpack she keeps packed from under the coats on the hook. And she's out the front door, fast up the path through the gate and onto the lane. She couldn't come within spitting distance of another person if she wanted to out here. And she won't be long. Just an hour before sunset. She'll be back before Matt even knows she's gone.
Sarah Moss, reading from the film. And so, just to be clear, Kate and her son are in 2 weeks of lockdown. They're not supposed to leave the house at all. They're not supposed to as much as go up the path or go into the fell, even though there's nobody there. So, Sarah, that section that you read for us, it's quite early in the novel. There are long paragraphs. There's a sense of a building frantic rhythm to her thoughts. It gets more and more fragmented. Why did you want to write a novel that responded to COVID?
I know it sounds ridiculous to say, but it didn't feel like a choice. It was the thing I had to write. I don't mean had to as in was compelled. I mean had to as in that was what was present to me and for me to write. I was actually working on something else. Well, not really working on something else, officially working on something else, and in fact not doing very much. and then this came to mind.
How then did you approach it so that people wouldn't just run away screaming?
I think some people have run away screaming, and I think that's okay. I wanted to write a novel that would begin to give shape to some of the experiences that we'd all been having. And of course, those experiences vary a little bit between countries and between places. I mean, I moved internationally in the course of COVID, so we got the British version and then the Irish version. But it was beginning to seem to me that we could make art out of this. It could be in story and music and film, and that it would get folded into the human experience in the way that everything else that's ever happened to people has. And as I thought that, things that had been stuck for me began to move again. And I think for some people that's true. Clearly, some readers are deeply relieved and pleased to have a novel that reflects some of what's been happening, and other people don't want to go anywhere near that. So I think that's fine. There are lots of different ways of reading.
And just to be clear, this is a magnificent novel that takes us into these experiences by focusing on just a handful of characters and very particular experiences. But it's not just Kate and it's not just her son. There is a woman next door named Alice. She's feeling scratchy too, but maybe in a different way to Kate. And part of it is, it seems, that she's being treated as an older woman. She's being patronised. She's also more vulnerable than some people. Why?
She's been having cancer treatment. And because of that and because of her age, she's officially labelled as vulnerable and needing to take extra care. And she's never really felt vulnerable before. She's being pushed, because of her age principally, she's being pushed into a role that's deeply unfamiliar and uncomfortable to her. Really imagined as someone who can only receive and not give care. And she's not used to that and she doesn't like it.
And so she has a certain relationship to Kate and her son because she lives next door and she can see them. And it's not a spoiler, both because it happens early in the book and because you've given it to us in that reading. Kate, it's too much. She has to head out. She needs to go onto that landscape that she knows. But what happens?
Everything that possibly can go wrong does, really. She gets into difficulties. She falls. Mountain rescue have to be called. And that came from me. I was thinking partly about that narrative of heroes. I imagine it was the same in Australia, certainly in both Britain and Ireland. Healthcare workers and emergency services workers and volunteers were being presented as heroes in the way that the people I knew found, again, very, very uncomfortable and difficult. So in a way, Kate is behaving like an idiot. She's breaking the rules and it goes wrong in all the ways it possibly can. And then there's Rob, who is the mountain rescue volunteer, who is in some ways the hero because he's volunteering for the emergency services and he gets called out to help rescue her. But I wanted to make those characters, well, those characters are more complicated than that. Alice is kind of pushed out and witnessing from the side, except that she can't leave her house either. So everybody's watching and caring and worrying about each other, but they can't actually make the connections that would enable that care and concern to pass between them, or it's difficult for them to do that.
It takes a while in the book, though, for this to be a story that is about rescue and heroism. And before that, there's this terrible anxiety and anticipation. And having read a number of your other books as well, it strikes me that you're really interested in dread and unease. So can you talk to us about dread and unease and what that means to you as a writer?
That's really interesting. I think of myself as a writer who's interested in finding ways to think well and beautifully about what's hard to bear or hard to tolerate, whether that's climate change or mortality or pandemic or, you know, whatever it is. There are these things that we, humankind, cannot bear very much reality that we can't look at for very long or very clearly. And I'm interested in literature that finds ways for us to look at things clearly but beautifully, and ideally finishing in places that are not just dread. Sometimes that's hard to find, but that we bring our humanity and our art and our capacity for making and creativity and storytelling to things that are hard to think about. And it's interesting that comes over as dread, but yes, that would make sense.
This is Radio National Summer, and on Best of the Festivals, we're listening to a session from the 2022 Melbourne Writers' Festival. Writer and novelist Sarah Moss is in conversation with RN's Kate Evans.
In your novel Summer Water, for example, you take us to a holiday camp, but it's damp, it's bleak, it's always raining, and there are these individual families. Again, you've got people who are isolated, but they're looking at each other. So is that a landscape of families that interest you, or isolation? I mean, what is it that you're reaching for?
It's partly a literal and metaphorical interest in archaeology, in the way that landscapes are shaped by and hold human activity. For me, landscapes are always readable, and I'm aware that I'm speaking about European and particularly British and Irish landscapes, which will be readable in different ways from others. But we sometimes speak about nature and landscape as if they're separate from humanity, or as if we're somehow exempt from nature. And it's so obvious to me that you find the interesting things when you recognise that that's not true. I was doing an event about this book at one point, and somebody said, why do you write about people who live off the land? And I thought, what do you think we all live off? You know, where does your food come from? Where does your body go? Who are these people who are living not off the land? It makes no sense to me. We're part of that. We're inseparable from it. So I'm interested in the stories that come out of that recognition that, I suppose, dust we are, and to dust we shall return. But meanwhile, here we are.
I'm so glad you mentioned archaeology, though, the layers in a landscape and the layers under it, because that's something that you make explicit in your novel Ghost Wall, with a character, a working class man who, with his family, is a sort of practical archaeologist, a reenactor. Can you actually explain what's going on in that book? Because it's so interesting.
I think one of the interesting things about that book is that there isn't actually any archaeology there. That family, Sylvie's family, join an approximately academic exercise in experimental archaeology, so trying out some of the technologies and life ways of Iron Age people on the borders of England and Scotland up by Hadrian's Wall. And I was interested in that partly because it's about borders and boundaries. I mean, Hadrian's Wall was built by the Romans ostensibly to keep the Picts out, but really as a marker of the edge of empire, the edge of civilization, you know, this side civilization, that side barbarity. And it's continued to tell that kind of story through the ensuing 2,000 years of history. And people sometimes say it marks the boundary between England and Scotland, but of course neither England nor Scotland existed at the time, but it gets repurposed. And I was writing when there was a lot of very intense discussion about the borders of Europe, you know, where is the edge of Europe? Is it in the English Channel, or is it on the Scottish border, or is it further north or further south? You know, where are we putting this? So it's really a book about national myths of origin and the quest for authenticity, and what those myths of origin might serve for individuals. I'm always very interested in how individuals take possession of political or historical narratives, what they mean to us in our own lives. So for Sylvie's father, Bill, the idea of Iron Age Britons, that of course they weren't Britons at all, they were just people who happened to be there, they're the authentic people. They're the ones who really have the right to be there. And if you can trace descendants from them, which nobody can because they didn't write anything down, then you have some claim on the land that you don't have if you come from anywhere else. But particularly in relation to British history, that just doesn't work because it's one wave of immigrants after another from prehistory until, I don't know, Victoria marries Albert and then on into the 21st century. You can't really do that kind of blood and soil narrative. So for him, he's clinging to a version of history in prehistory that simply doesn't work, but is essential to him. It must work for him. And in the reenactment, he's trying to get back. And of course, you can't get back, and there isn't actually anything to get back to, but he's trying to reconnect to ancient skills and ways of living. And the ideology of that has devastating effects for everybody else.
And at the same time, it's also a novel about families and violence and class. I'm interested, you said that blood and soil narrative, because it's been deployed politically, as you know, in Britain. So how much, you know, Ghost Wall and then Summer Water with this sort of atomised little community, and then The Fell with people isolated in the houses. How much are these also Brexit novels or responding to that sort of political?
In some ways, it would be quite nice to think they were just Brexit novels, but I think it's a wider problem than that. I think globally we're seeing a move towards that kind of thinking, which to me seems to be away from community and collectivism and the things that might actually save us in the face of climate change, which is a far bigger emergency than COVID or Brexit or you know, any of our smaller dramas. It's really about how people respond in a crisis. And I don't think it matters if the crisis that comes to hand for a particular country or a particular book is Brexit or COVID or immigration. I mean, you know, there are plenty of crises and reactions to them washing around. It's really how we respond. And I'm interested in exploring how far people respond by turning to community and how far they respond by turning away from community.
Well, let's get back to The Fell and to Kate, somewhere on a hillside. And this is not just about the shape of the hillside and those hidden paths and the trees and the shadows. There's a raven there. Tell us about the raven.
The raven is, I think, my first talking animal. The raven meets Kate on the hillside and makes a rude remark, which they do.
They do.
And yes, as she walks, the raven goes with her and she ends up trying to sing with it, but ravens don't really sing. And then in conversation with it, as everything goes wrong through the night.
What do these birds mean in English literature?
I think you can pretty much hijack them for whatever purpose you want, really. I worried briefly that I was appropriating other people's raven narratives, but it's actually my own raven narrative and we all have them. That particular one occurred to me when we were living in Iceland and I used to cycle along the coast path to work. It was about 15 kilometres. And at that point, nobody in Iceland cycled anywhere. It simply wasn't considered a viable means of transport. But I was scared of driving and I didn't like the buses and I do like cycling. So I cycled to work all through the Icelandic winter on this icy path. And it was usually dark because it's dark in Iceland in winter. And they had waist-height lighting so that it didn't cause light pollution, but you could see the path. And most mornings a raven, and of course I have no idea if it was the same raven, would come down and hop ahead of me down the lights as I was going. So it was always ahead of me and it would wait till I caught up and then say something not very complimentary and then move on three or four and wait for me to catch up and say something else. I did speak to it. I don't think I ever really thought it spoke to me, but I enjoyed it. And you quite often encounter them in the hills. Once you've got above the level where there are many other birds, you'll still get ravens and you'll hear them from quite far away. And then they come down and have a look at you and say something. And then they go away and say something from higher up and disappear and come back. And I like that idea of the companion bird and the way it comes to mean whatever you're carrying at the time.
They have a real place in Australian writing too, Ravens, and the Indigenous writer Melissa Lukashenko has a spectacular Talking Raven, who, if you haven't met it in too much lip, I would recommend the Talking Raven. It doesn't involve a bicycle. There's a motorbike instead, and it's really quite an exchange. But as people begin to worry about Kate, you've already mentioned the rescuer. And I suspect this man in your book actually doesn't get very many words on the page in terms of, you know, how much time he's there. But it feels as though you've given him an entire backstory, an entire life. So what interests you about these rescuers?
I was thinking about volunteers and volunteering. I've always done some kind of voluntary work, and I've always been very suspicious of my motives and what it serves in my life. And I don't think it really matters, because if what you're doing is good, then I don't think your reasons are particularly important. But mountain rescue is very full on as volunteering goes. I mean, you can be out on the hills for a long time and it's rarely convenient, and the weather's usually awful and it's often at night. And for mountaineers, they're essential. They're mentally essential. You hope you never call them, but you need to know that they're there. And I was thinking about the emergency services during the pandemic, but generally, and again, thinking about community and society, that the idea that when you have totally messed up and it's all your own fault, there are still people who will come and get you and care for you. And it doesn't really matter if it's your own fault or if it was some outrageous act of fate or if it was something that's been coming for you for years and it finally got you, or it just came out of a clear blue sky. They will come. And they will look after you and they will give you care. And that seemed, as I thought about it, such an extraordinary achievement for people who don't necessarily like each other and may not have anything in common and may be politically completely different and incompatible. But nonetheless, that's what happens. And we need to believe in it. We need to know that it will happen, even if the individuals doing it may have mixed motives or may be deeply flawed. Nonetheless, that's part of the social contract. And when you think about it, that's really moving.
Well, and he also has to think about risk. He thinks about other friends he's lost on the mountain. And so as this book went on, I felt as though we were coming face to face with mortality, with death. So, I mean, is this a book about death? I mean, is that too bold a way to put it?
I kind of want to say all books are books about death.
Or confronting it in some way?
Yes. Or the times when we think we want it also. I mean, Kate's not, she's not really doing proper risk assessment. She's not, she knows how to, and she always has done before, but she's not really behaving responsibly, not only in going out when she's not supposed to, but in the equipment she takes and the way she doesn't communicate and all the rest of it. It's partly about how much we want to be alive at times when we think we don't want to be alive.
And I guess that gets us back to COVID and the introspection that COVID might leave. And in the circumstances of this one night, it leads the women characters in particular, both Kate and Alice, to contemplate their mistakes. So I was interested that that was the focus you gave them, this sort of inward laceration.
I think certainly in England and a bit less in Ireland, and I don't know how it was in Australia, that was kind of encouraged by a lot of the COVID narratives. There was some very punitive stuff about how whatever goes wrong is all your own fault. And if you get sick, you should have been more careful. And if you're having trouble coping with staying at home, you should just count your blessings and be grateful. And it was a very angry, accusatory way of thinking and speaking about being alive and getting through the world. So I think in some sense it's in the weather there.
But it also meant, as well as, you know, mistakes, and that a lot of it felt quite gendered too. I mean, there's guilt and parenting, one of the great combinations of the world, of course, guilt and parenting. So tell us how that plays out for both of these women.
For Alice, whom I came to really love as I wrote, actually, I thought Kate would be my favourite, but I ended up very fond of Alice. She's in her 70s. Her daughter's grown up and living in London. They have these regular Zoom dates, which Alice doesn't always look forward to quite as much as she might.
They're a little bit excruciating.
Yeah. she's looking at her daughter's adult life quite critically. I mean, you know, nobody in this book is a saint. And wondering how much of it is her fault and where, you know, where are the limits of responsibility? And if you don't, frankly, approve very much of your middle-aged child, is it because you got it wrong or because she got it wrong? And, you know, at what point do you hold people responsible for their own actions or failings? Kate is parenting a teenager and actually really likes him in a way that Alice doesn't always really like her daughter. But it's a different stage of the balance of thinking about who's responsible for what, who can reasonably be expected to do what, how are our children, you know, whether they're 40 or 16, going to make their way in the world.
Actually, we haven't really talked about Matt, a character who I came to feel quite tenderly towards. I mean, possibly because I have a very tall, young teenage son myself. But do you feel tenderly towards your characters as you create them?
Yes. And particularly the teenagers. I mean, probably partly because I too have teenagers, but I think it's such an interesting stage in life from a writing point of view because those stories are just taking shape. And it's interesting talking to people in midlife how much of our lives now were really shaped by experiences over a very intense few years in our teens. And if you think about the history of fiction, it's always been really interested in teenagers. I sometimes point out to students that most of Austen and Bronte in the Victorian novel is in some sense YA. I mean, all of the protagonists are under 21.
But also in your work, you seem so interested in the family and both the sort of intimacy and the resentments that can come out in a family. And I think the resentments were more obvious in some of your earlier novels. But the landscape of the family, I mean, that must be just such a rich landscape for any novelist, I guess.
Yes, and really what the novel has been interested in pretty much from the beginning, and I think given new energy by Freudian and psychoanalytic ways of thinking about family. I mean, if our lives are to some extent the stories told by our ancestors, then, of course, you're going to write about family. Mm-hmm. That's where the stories come from.
Again, back to the characters in The Fell. I mean, we've talked about their mistakes and their guilt and their anxieties and the things that they're doing wrong. But there is triumph and joy in this novel. There are sort of flashes of it. And the singing is there and unexpectedly, may I just say, roller skating. If that's a giveaway, you just have to keep reading to find out. But how important is it to include, you know, without wanting to sound too mawkish, but, you know, joy and hope in a story like this as well?
It's not even that I think, oh dear, you know, we've put in 500 grams of misery, let's add a pinch of joy. I think that's just the shape of experience, isn't it? And even when things are at their most awful, there'll be a bit of laughter. And we're always, most of us, at least when we're well, are always seeking little bits of pleasure and joy and reason to be happy and to keep going. And they're always there. I think that's really, really important. I was one of my students a year or two ago, we had a really warm spell in February and I was sitting outside eating an ice cream and one of my students came past and said, you know, this is a sign of the end of the world. You shouldn't be enjoying it. I thought, well, it can be a sign of the end of the world and I can be enjoying it. You know, if I, me choosing not to have an ice cream will not give us back our winters. So I might as well.
A very earnest response from a very earnest young insect, I guess, if they didn't want you to have the ice cream as well. Now, look, this is a sort of sideways question, Sarah, but it partly comes from things you've said elsewhere as well, because we've talked about place and landscape and the specificity of The Fell, what that place means to you, all of which you've written about so beautifully. But I believe you don't like the phrase nature writing or nature writer, and I wonder if you could talk about that.
I think it constructs, it's what I was saying earlier, partly, it constructs the idea of something that's not nature. And I don't know what that might be. Because nature is in our bodies, it's in our writing. I mean, I can't, even if I'm writing on a computer, it is hands made of flesh and bone, fueled by food which grows in the earth that allow that writing to happen. Thinking comes from energy, comes from the body, comes from plants, comes from the land. I don't think we get to exempt ourselves from nature. Actually, when we do, it tends to go catastrophically wrong. So I don't really know what other kind of writing there might be. And I think sometimes people say I write eco-fiction, and I really don't think I do. I don't think I'm any more interested in climate and environment than anybody else. I think I write fiction about living in the 21st century, which is always going to be eco-fiction because that's the biggest show in town. You know, that's what we all think about. So why would you not, you know, how would you not write eco-fiction? Why would you not write eco-fiction? It would be like trying to write fiction without people in it or something. I mean, you can do that. And I'm not setting out rules for how anybody should write, but it seems to me that humanity and nature and environment are in no way separable. So it's a bit odd to come up with phrases suggesting that nature and environment are special interests or minority pursuits.
On Best of the Festivals, we're listening to writer and novelist Sarah Moss in conversation with Kate Evans. This is Radio National Summer, and this session comes from the 2022 Melbourne Writers Festival.
Do you find categories in fiction, in literature, useful? And if you do, where would you place your own work?
I find them useful as a teacher because, you know, you can organise your courses around them. More widely, no, I probably don't. I mean, they're clearly convenient for publishers and knowing where to go in the bookshop, but no, I try to read as widely as possible and to overcome my prejudices. And when people ask me what kind of fiction I write, I say rather helplessly literary fiction, meaning please can we talk about something else now? it seems an odd category. I mean, it's all literary.
Yes, I guess sometimes people want to focus on the size. I mean, you said, you know, nature and eco-writing is the biggest game in town, but people like to focus on the size of a canvas, which can often be a way of constraining and containing writing that looks at the family or looks at domestic lives or looks inside the kitchen rather than at something outside it. I mean, how do you respond to where your work is placed in terms of scale?
Do you mean the kind of the focus on time and short periods and small
time
places?
Or domesticity or family life, which you seem to write very well and sort of fiercely, I'd say.
Probably do most things fiercely. I think at the beginning, particularly when I wrote Night Waking, which is a novel partly about parenthood and small children, there was more kind of Sarah Moss's writing domestic fiction. And I was thinking, well, again, what other kind is that? You know, he looked at Tolstoy recently or Dickens. Yeah, occasionally people say you're always writing about the washing up. And I think, well, how much time is spent in your house doing the washing up? I think there's a political point about writing about the things that people actually spend most of their time doing. And I said earlier that I'm interested in the way politics is manifested in people's narratives of their own lives. You know, the personal is political, the washing up is political, the ironing is political, the laundry is political. But there are also ways of showing love and care. You can say you love people all you like, but if you wash their socks and cook their dinner, you really, really love them.
Yes, and as political as the washing up is, it's also about who does and doesn't.
Exactly, yes. So it's really where there's a collision of politics and love, because I think we show care in domestic work. We show care for each other in domestic work. But it's also the site of huge resentment and inequality. And I was thinking about that partly in relation to home during the pandemic. I mean, home was presented as being a refuge. There were signs all over England, less so in Ireland, saying stay home, stay safe. And I kept thinking, but home's not safe for an awful lot of people. And for even a lot of people who are physically safe at home aren't particularly emotionally safe at home. So there's a fantasy about domesticity, which actually fiction has been undermining since the 18th century. And I suppose maybe I see that as part of my work.
Yes, and for a character like Kate, that staying home imprisons her in very particular ways, and we feel her getting just more and more frantic about the need to get outside that door. And her son looks at her and knows that she would very rarely spend that much time in their house. But Sarah, can I ask you, I mean, the novel is set in the north of England, which I think is the area that you grew up in, so you know it well. But as we're speaking to you now, you're in Dublin. So what is your role there?
I'm teaching creative writing at University College Dublin, which I enjoy enormously. I say bravely because it all starts again on Monday. And, yeah, being in Ireland and doing Irish book things, which is also lovely.
Because it does feel as though the Irish literary culture is very exciting and very dynamic. I mean, it has been for a long time, but like just this year, Audrey McGee's The Colony, Louise Kennedy's Trespassers, there's a new book by Donald Ryan, I think just out, and Claire Keegan's book, Small Things Like These, just shortlisted for the Booker Prize. So, I mean, from the outside, it seems like it's a really quite thrilling literary scene. Does it feel like that from the inside too?
Yes. Yeah, no, I'm really happy to be here, and yes, it does. And teaching at UCD, I feel as if I'm really involved in that. I mean, some of those writers have come through UCD. You know, we've got people graduating and getting publishing contracts, and there's a lovely sense of being near the roots of the thing.
So as a literary scholar, and UCD, that's University College Dublin, yes, how do you find time to write?
If you're lucky, and if you're in an English literature department, academia gives you, at least in theory, it gives you a bit of time to write, and you can kind of insist that that theory becomes practice some of the time, certainly in a good department, which I am at the moment, because that counts as your research. Academia is also very flexible. I mean, you can write in the afternoon and then do the marking or the teaching prep in the evening and push your time around to work. And I think people do find time for the things that matter most to them, usually.
As well as a writer, obviously, as an academic and as a teacher, you are so engaged with the practice of reading. If I could just sort of ask a big picture question about influences. Is there a book that you think of as a really touchstone book for you, something that has really shaped you?
There are several. The one I'm thinking about again at the moment is Dorothy Wordsworth's Grasmere Journals. I wrote my PhD partly on Wordsworth, but I was increasingly interested in Dorothy. And what I like about those journals is that it's absolutely the opposite of the room of one's own. She's interweaving reading and writing with cooking and walking the hills and chatting to the neighbours and getting the laundry done and looking after herself and looking after William. And it's a sense of a kind of a weaving, a basketry of different kinds of activity where the domestic work and the time spent outside and the reading feed the writing, which feeds the domestic work and the time outside. And it seems a much more organic and accessible way of imagining the writing life than many of the 19th and early 20th century ones, which kind of assume that somebody else is emptying the bins and sweeping the fire and cooking the dinner and that you are, you know, in your room writing all the time, which has never been my experience.
So are these journals that you return to? I mean, are they sort of inspiration? How do they work for you?
Yeah, I know them well enough that I remember them more often than I read them, but I do reread them. And, of course, because they're journals and it's little bits, I mean, it's a rare day that gets more than a page, you can just dip in and read a little bit and then go off and do something else or read something else.
But in terms of this latest novel of yours, The Fell, does it feel like there are other books or traditions that have influenced it or that you'd want to see a sort of antecedents or somehow put them on the same shelf?
That's an interesting question. I was thinking a lot about poetry and folk song while I was writing it, and I might want to put it interestingly with some of that literature about who is allowed to be where, which bodies are allowed to be in which places, and a lot of English and particularly Scottish folk songs are very much about that, stories of dispossession, return, violence, suppression, centred in that fundamental question about which bodies are allowed to be on which land.
And Kate belts them out as she's walking across the fell, if you're wondering. So are you a singer? Are you singing these in your head with your character? No.
No. I actually forget to listen to music for weeks at a time. I'm a words person. But I've read a lot of poetry. I read a lot of poetry as a child with my grandmother, and she encouraged me to memorise a lot of it. And, of course, when you're nine, you can memorise enormous chunks of things that will be much harder in later life, and they stay with you. So those rhythms go with me all the time. And if I'm struggling on a run or climbing a mountain, that's what I'll be saying to myself.
Are you superstitious about new writing projects, or can you tell us about things that you're doing? Some writers hate to talk about projects that are coming.
Oh, well, I'm so superstitious that I have a stunt novel I talk about when I'm actually doing something completely different, but I can talk about the stunt novel if you like.
Is that like an imagined, a totally made up one that doesn't really exist?
No, it does exist, and I've been sort of circling it for at least 12 years, and between novels I go back and write some of it, or I reread all the primary texts and make another set of notes that are really very similar to the notes I made last time I was doing this. And I talk to my agent about it, and I tell people that's what I'm working on, and then I don't actually write it. I swerve at the last minute and write something completely different.
Is that because you don't actually want to finish it?
I do. I just can't quite see how. And every time I take a run at it, I come up with something slightly different, but I'm never happy with it. So one day you say, I really will.
So I guess that's a way of saying, no, you don't. You're not going to tell us about the next thing. Do you still write non-fiction as well? Because you have written academic studies of food and of your time in Iceland as well.
Not much. Bits. I don't think I'm ever going to write academic prose again. I wasn't very good at it. There may be an invented footnote somewhere.
I think there's quite a bit of that around, to be honest.
The moment I knew it really wasn't for me was when I realised that I was making the final draft of an academic piece of writing. I hadn't written down the page numbers of an 18th century text I was quoting. And it was before digitisation, so I'd read it in the British Library and I was living 300 miles away. And my options were to pay for a load of extra childcare, rush up to London and check the page numbers, or just make up a number.
Yes. Is there anything else that you've read recently that you'd like to share with us? Anything that you've just loved, whether it's a new release or something that you've just discovered?
Olivia Lang's Everybody, a book about freedom, I've recently read and been raving about to friends. I think Olivia Lang's a really interesting thinker and writer, and that's a great book. I'm just looking at the pile. Unfortunately, the pile supporting my laptop has all the spines at the back, so I can't tell you.
I often ask people these questions and then I actually see them turning around or occasionally standing up in the middle of an interview and going to a bookshelf and saying, this book is amazing.
Yes.
And that's what's changed with Zoom, that I'd only ever interview people in studios. And now I do radio interviews with writers in their room and they will stand up and go to their bookshelf and grab something and tell me about it halfway through an interview. And there's something, I mean, again, it's sort of intimate, isn't it? Because we're inside each other's houses in COVID in a way that we never have been before. So, yeah, so many things have changed, haven't they, with COVID? And yet it's also things that happened in 1919 and things that happened in other years with other epidemics. And we're just seeing it for the first time, which is fascinating. And so you have done the brave thing of, I think it's quite bold in a way, to write a novel that takes us into the COVID experience while we're still bruised by it and we still don't know what's going to happen next week.
Yeah, I didn't realise it was brave at the time. I mean, probably in the way that one always does these brave or foolish, you know, when people start saying it's very brave and you think, uh-oh. But I didn't realise that until it was published. And a lot of the reviews were very nice, but they all finished by saying, it's too soon. And I was thinking, well, how do you know? You know, it's news to me that as if it needs to be put away to mature like a Christmas pudding and then someone's going to raise a flag and say, now you can write about it. I thought, this is a deeply strange way of thinking about things.
Well, particularly because evidently it's never going to end and we're going to be wearing masks forever. So on that uplifting note, Sarah Moss, the latest novel, The Fell, is published by Picador read this one, and also I really highly commend you to read everything else that Sarah Moss has ever written. Please do thank her.
Novelist and academic Sarah Moss speaking with Kate Evans at this year's Melbourne Writers' Festival about her latest book, The Fell. I'm Cassie McCullough, and if you want to hear more about books and writing, then make sure you join me and Kate Evans for The Bookshelf and Claire Nichols for The Book Show each week on Radio National or via the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.